Good afternoon, everybody. This is Patrick from the Poison Pen Bookstore in Scottsdale, Arizona. And thanks for tuning in to another of our virtual events. And today, we are delighted to have Joshua Hood back with us to talk about his brand new book, The Guardian. And Josh has signed a batch of books for us, as always. And so I'll put some links in the comments field. Sorry. Should you wish to purchase one. We also still have a couple of copies left of the Treadstone rendition, also signed by Josh. And also joining us is Mark Greeny. He's going to be doing the heavy lifting with the interview. I shouldn't say heavy lifting, Bar, when you have that.
When I have the cast evidence here.
Literally, in this case.
Right.
But I don't have any more signed copies of Burner, but we do have copies, which can be read just as easily unsigned.
That's very true.
And I'll put a link too. So if you have questions for Joshua or Mark, go ahead and put them in the comments field, and Barbara will bring me back on screen towards the end of the hour. So Barbara, over to you.
Thank you very much, Patrick. I'm going to say at the outset, if I look stoned, I am. I've just had surgery. Right. So my performance today may be erratic. And if so, I'm sure that Mark and Patrick and Josh will save the day. But as I understand it, this is the start of a new military fiction series, which Josh is really well qualified to write. So most of you watching this will know Mark, whose amazing Gray Man series and other work is spectacular. Although Mark himself, while you've done some amazing things training, but you're not actually ex-military.
No, I'm not. But, I'm an ex-bartender.
It's right. Not quite the
same. You're smarter than all of us.
Right. Better training for writing novels. But Mark has diligently learned to master some of the craft of his characters. If you watch him on Instagram, he's frequently in jets and other kind of situations, which is great. So Joshua, I love this, joined the army after getting an English degree. I'm not quite sure I see that was a natural progression, Josh.
Seemed like a good idea at the time.
Well, it worked out well for you. Anyway, he served as a squad leader with 101 508th Parachute Infantry Regiment in Afghanistan, where he is decorated for valor in Operation Furious Pursuit. He's also been a SWAT team member with the Shelby County Sheriff's Department in Memphis, and is the USA Today bestselling author of several books, including Four and the Robert Ludlum Universe. I'm getting used to saying author verse because, we have the Clancy verse and the Cussler verse and the Ludlum verse, and so it goes.
And Mark started all the verses too.
Yeah, but I think it's great for fans so that the characters that they like get to continue a life, and we're seeing some interesting transitions. Kyle Mills is retiring from Vince Flynn and handing it over to Don Bentley. Don Bentley is sending the Jack Ryan Jr. to MP Woodward, I think it is, and the Clancy Sr. that's being written by Mark Cameron is moving to two guys. So, it's a real brotherhood, isn't it? It's almost like you all left the service in order to form a writing brotherhood that's, kind of the same deal. I love it.
Barbara, can I jump in there and remind you that you and I and Kyle Mills and his wife and my wife, we all went out to dinner, one day before Kyle announced that, and he didn't, it's like, there's very like surreptitious, I guess it was in the works or it was already a done deal, but it was funny because you and I were talking a couple of days later going like, wow, he's good at keeping a secret because that did not come up at dinner.
I'm still sulking. I was really mad, which is the reason I know about the new transition, which I probably shouldn't have mentioned, but Don didn't want to risk pissing me off again. So there we are. But as I said, it's great. And it's interesting too, because this way different writers, have they have to stay within the universe, but they progress their writers in different ways. And it's not just in military fiction. The Robert Parker estate still goes on. And we all know that the Arthur Conan Doyle, Sherlock Holmes thing is going to live forever.
Yeah.
And so, how great for readers. Anyway, The Guardian, I thought the whole first chapter in which Josh explains who this guy is and what his job is was absolutely fascinating. I also had to look up Djibouti. Where is Djibouti?
It's in the Mideast, kind of in this like perfect, I'm probably saying this wrong. Mark, you're better with geography than me, but it's kind of this linchpin of the Persian Gulf, and everything kind of has to go that way. You have Somalia there, you have Yemen there, you have Gibraltar kind of on the other side.
Ethiopia.
Right? Ethiopia. It's
yeah.
Fascinating place that I'd read about that, you know, there were special operations things that happened there at Camp Limonaire or Limonier, however you say it, but
step in here as a French speaker. I'm assuming that they're French. Anyways, Le Meunier. But they probably call it lemonade.
Well, America's been over there so long, who knows? But it was this kind of place that I'd heard about but never looked into. And I found it pretty fascinating that the French Foreign Legion had been there before. And at the time of writing the book, it was kind of the only place where anybody was fighting.
Uh-huh. Well, I recently did an event with Joseph Cannon, who I think is just like an icon in spy fiction, and a new author called I.S. Berry. She's a former CIA op. And it's a wonderful spy story, more like Le Carre with less action and more, you know, Le Carre kind of stuff. It is set in Bahrain, and I never really have thought much about Bahrain. It turns out our Fifth Fleet is stationed in Bahrain. So you're kind of in that same area, and partly, I think, because the situation with Iran and Saudi Arabia and the U.S. has changed quite a lot recently, and so it's coming into the news, except, of course, when the Russians do their thing. And,
yeah.
You know, if you'd been a thriller writer, what would you have written about this weekend? I thought about that, whether all of you would be, you know, kind of wondering how you could apply what happened to your books.
I was texting Mark because he was driving.
Yeah. Yeah, he was texting me because it was a road trip day and I was behind the wheel for 8 hours and I was like, what? I was going 85 miles an hour and going, Russia's doing what? But you asked what we would do as writers. It's like, yeah. I would have written it as a novel and not as a short story, which is how it played out.
That's true.
Just a few hours. But it's absolute crazy, crazy stuff. Crazy stuff.
Well, it's not over yet. And I think mm-hmm. You know, the spin doctors are madly at work. I was talking to Matt Quirk. I don't know if you read Matthew Quirk, but I love the idea.
Love
so he came to the store to talk about Inside Threat last week. And he started as a journalist, or at least wrote for the Atlantic Monthly.
The Atlantic. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, in Washington. And we were talking about the fact that, you know, at least when I was young, there are only three TV channels, and we watched Walter Cronkite, and it never occurred to you that Walter Cronkite was talking about fake news or, that it was fact-checked and the whole bit and reliable, and it wasn't entertainment. It was actually news, whereas today,
you can go out and select the news that you want to hear, and it's pretty scary when you think about it.
It really is, and designed, sorry, I had to go like that, designed for entertainment rather than information. Yeah. So I think you guys, in lots of ways, your military fiction is a corrective to a lot of the nonsense that, you know, has gone on in the news media. I mean, Don's recent book about Afghanistan, your books, and now Josh's book, can tell you more than if you're, you know, thinking it's news. Anyway, I'll be quiet here, but I would like Josh to talk to us about this outfit that we find his main character in at the outset before he transitions.
Well, it starts off where he is a PJ, a pararescueman, and I'm going into this book, I kind of wanted to do a little half step maybe out of the contemporary military thrillers, because I feel that anytime you write a book that has a military-esque protagonist, you immediately kind of get pigeonholed into that. And honestly, I didn't know if I'd ever have any more ideas when the war of Afghanistan kind of stopped. So started looking for new protagonists, and nobody except Simon Gervais had ever written about a PJ. And what they do is they're basically rescue specialists. So back in Vietnam, they were the guys that would fly in, and when a pilot went down behind enemy lines, they would jump in and rescue them. And I found it kind of fascinating that you would have someone that has this unique skill set, but also has the capability of, you know, going with SEAL Team 6 or Delta guys on operations, but their primary mission isn't to be a trigger puller, it's to actually save lives. And that was an interesting juxtaposition for me.
Yeah, can I ask you, so your hero, Travis Lane in The Guardian, is not just a pararescue person, but he's a former member of their special tactical squadron. I think it's called the 24 STS. Can you talk about that group a little bit? Because, you know, a lot of people don't think of, well, when they do think of Air Force special operations, they're thinking about something else, you know?
Yeah, and I get myself in these issues, these troubles, and you probably can relate, where you hear something and you're like, that would be really cool about a PJ. And then you kind of start going down this rabbit hole, and going in, there basically is, you know, a vanilla side and kind of a dark side. So the 24th STS Special Tactics Service is the, I believe, the Air Force only tier one unit. So they, along with the SEAL Team 6 and Delta, am I forgetting anybody else? I feel like there's four, but
you know, I guess like the Marine Raiders, are they considered? Maybe not.
Yeah, maybe they are, but I don't know if they're careful. We're going to piss off.
I mean,
Brad,
I know
Taylor.
They're not JSOC or anything.
But, yeah. And so that's what I'm trying to say is that, you know, the 24th is a part of JSOC. Yeah. And so they are trained, they go through this long pipeline, they call it Superman School, just to become a PJ. And after they've done that for a while, they can be selected to try out for, and they call it their green team. And then that's where they learn all the CQB stuff and everything, because basically with the War on Terror, these other tier one units, they needed a medic on steroids. And, you know, the Marine Raiders have now what's called a SARC, I believe, and it's like a special operations medic. But the only other ones like that are, what is it, that 18 Deltas or whatever, the Special Forces medics. I'm probably, that's been a long day, so my brain's not working. So, but nobody will really talk about it because it's barely new. And so it's hard. You're trying to kind of go through all this open source stuff. You're trying to figure out what's what, where these guys are stationed, what exactly they would do. I was able to talk to a few PJs, and for me, I guess sometimes you get in a situation where you're talking to a guy who's done that, and you have in your mind, well, I need him to do this. And they're, you know, this guy's telling me these like ridiculously awesome stories. Like he haloed in Afghanistan right towards the beginning. They were having some vote. They were voting for the first time, and this helicopter Hind had flown up to like the northeast region of Afghanistan to get these ballots. And then they started going back, and as they're trying to go down the mountain, the helicopter goes down, the snowstorm. And so America was so, you know, they wanted this election to work that they actually called some PJs in, and they haloed in during this blizzard to go get a ballot box. And so he's telling me all these stories. I'm like, what about like the shooting and everything? And, you know, they, a lot of them don't see that as their primary mission, which is cool. And the dudes who do are literally still doing it, so they won't tell you anything. So
right,
it was kind of like trying to do as much research as I could, and then there's probably some inaccuracies in there, but at some point you got to bend that line and be like, all right, I've researched enough.
Right. You tell your story.
Write me a nasty gram if I messed it up.
Yeah, exactly. You're going to get the emails for the rest of your life, but at some point you got to turn a book. So you were in the military. Were you aware of pararescue when you were in the military, and if you were, like, what reputation did they have, or was it something that you being in the Army, it was just never came up?
The first time I ever saw anything, I think it was on National Geographic. They had this like it was like these snippets where they actually follow the PJ through the pipeline. And I think that this is all I remember. There might've been more like Rangers or whatever, but there was one that followed a PJ all the way through his like little pipeline. It was pretty short. And he ended up, I think, getting killed in action. And then the next time I heard about one was kind of on when reading, I think, Roberts Ridge and stuff. I think Chapman had been a PJ, and then he became a JTAC. And then fast forward a few years, 2008, 9, or 10, around there, they had another National Geographic kind of show that showed on where it was like there was these PJs in Afghanistan, and they'd go out on these little missions. I can't remember what the name is, but I ended up buying that little series on Nat Geo. You can get off of Amazon.
I remember like that. Yeah, I remember that.
They'd be like, Leroy Jenkins, every time they would. I remember the helicopters were called Pedro, but I can't remember what the name of it was. And so I'm watching this stuff, and like, you get that little tingle, like, man, that would be cool.
Yeah.
Write a book about these dudes, but like, what would they do?
Yeah. Well, okay, so let's go a little bit into the book. You have a private military company. So your hero, Travis Lane, we've established, is a former pararescueman who takes a job, and I'm not giving anything away because it's all the early parts of the book, takes a job with a private military company called Broadside Solutions, which is an awesome title. It's like there's going to be a company called Broadside Solutions. And I'm going to do something I don't think I've ever done when I've interviewed somebody before. I'm going to read a little bit of your book. It's just a paragraph because I thought it was really, so you don't have to. because I thought this was really good. This is like it's 100 pages in, and it's two characters talking about Broadside Solutions and what they do, because I think it really establishes. It doesn't establish the plot of the story because there's so much more. This company is very not exactly on the up and up. But the setup of the company that Travis joins, I think, is really interesting. So these are two guys talking. Officially, Broadside Solutions is a private security company that offers evacuation and retrieval services for individuals who operate in high-risk environments, Jones said. What does that mean in English? It means that if you're rich and you get into trouble in a foreign country, we will help get you out. If you're stupid rich, we will send in a team of pipe hitters to come and literally take you out. And so that's basically not the premise of the book, but the premise of this company that Travis goes to work for. And I thought that was really, really interesting. And it gave me, so first off, is Broadside based on a real company? I know the type of research you do. So is it an amalgamation of things, or is there a version of this?
Yeah, and this is one of those things where the first time I heard about, there's a company a long time ago called Sovereign Deed, and this came up in a conversation with my brother when we were both out of the military and we were trying to figure out what to do, and they were looking at contracting work, and his friend had bought this policy with this company called Sovereign Deed. And basically, it's called a lifetime continuum policy. And so if you were in the United States and there was this, something bad happened, like a tornado or whatever, and you had a policy with them, they would come get you, and then they would take you to their little place. I think they called it the Haven. And so I kind of filed that back, and in the back of my mind, I really didn't think about it too much. I thought it was like a cool idea. I wasn't writing books yet. But then I started writing books, and I brought it up. I was reading an article actually about Brad Thor, and somewhere during this article, they talk about him suing a company called Sovereign Deed. And I'm like, I remember that, but I don't know where. So I started just interested to know what's kind of going on. I Googled that, and an article had come out where this company Sovereign Deed was real in a way, but I guess Brad Thor was one of the first people. He had just written a book. I can't remember. I think The Apostle or something. And he actually, I believe at the time, it had a fatwa put out on him. And I remember like on TV, like Glenn Beck being like, don't like release this book. And I think they were pretty serious about like going to try to kill him. So he obviously got very security conscious, and somehow he met the owner of this company called Sovereign Deed. And I don't think, in a way, I guess I owe this book to Brad Thor, because I don't think it would have become, I would have paid much more attention to it if his name hadn't been attached to it. And so that company, I believe, it in that iteration is no longer in existence. But the idea, when I was in Iraq and Afghanistan, I got to see a lot of PMC guys work, and they're kind of, you know, in that gray zone, which we all kind of like to write about. I'd read, I think, License to Kill. I cannot remember the guy's name.
Robert Young Pelton.
Yeah, I love him. That
oh my God, I've talked to him before. He's so cool.
I love his mustache. He's like, And you know, you read that book, and it talks about when that kind of mercenary PMC culture started, when they'd go to Vegas when SHOT Show was nothing, and they'd be hanging out, like talking in strippers and all this stuff. And so, like, I've always been kind of fascinated with that world, but it kind of made me like wonder, like, what is the price of a person's life? You know, it's if you have enough money, like, wouldn't that be, you know, I'm going to save you, but I'm not going to save this person because you're poor.
And right.
That's kind of interesting.
Yeah. That really leads me, everything you just said leads me into my next question, really weirdly, actually. This is, like, you and I have been friends for 10 years or something. I've never asked you this question, but this is like, this isn't just a setup for an interview. It's like, I really am curious about this. You know a ton about PMCs. Obviously, you were a SWAT, you're a Shelby County Sheriff guy here in where we live. And you obviously were in the military in Afghanistan. Was there ever a time in your life, you're also like a family man, was there ever a time in your life where you thought, I'll go for that money and get into the PMC world? Was that ever something you considered?
There was a brief time when, between the love, right when the Ukraine started, where I received a call, and I didn't really know where my book career was going. And I didn't know, I still don't really know, but they were offering, you know, when I was in SWAT, I had the opportunity to go to a lot of driving schools. I went to the DEA driving school, and I did a lot of driving in the military and some other things. And I've been to the Secret Service personal protection detail. So they were offering, there's a company looking for guys with certain skill sets. I happen to know the team leader, who's a sergeant major in the 3rd or 5th group, but he was a scout sniper team leader when I was in the 82nd. And they were looking for people to run these extraction details. They were calling them thunder runs. And I don't really know what they were kind of getting into, but it was like, you look at it, you're like, that would be really cool. And then you realize that if they're offering you that much money, you're probably going to get fucked up, messed up. And so I brought it to Amy. I was like, look, we would have to work in it again for a year. And she'd be like, yeah, but you know, you would probably get messed up. And so that was kind of my only thing, really.
Brush with it. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I would have loved to do something like, you know, reporters do, where they kind of get to follow these dudes around, but you know,
in bed,
yeah, I think that would be really awesome. But like, once you get married and you're a family man, like, you're not allowed to do anything cool. Like, I'm surprised Allison like lets you scuba dive with sharks anymore.
Well, she doesn't go with me, so I think that's the thing. She's like, well, let them eat you. I'll be on the beach with a cocktail.
So like, was that an alligator or was it a crocodile? I can't ever remember them, but
I can't remember either. They told me at the time, I knew at the time what it was I was up against, but yeah, it was no big deal. So I really like this book. I think this is so well written, and I really enjoy your writing style. I'm not surprised by it because I've read other stuff you've written, but this is my favorite book that you've written. You have a really, really good visual writing style, very cinematic. And when I say that, that sounds like I'm talking about action. And of course I'm talking about action, but the way that you write is very visual in every scene. There's a scene where Travis and his sister are sitting in a kitchen drinking together and talking about the family farm. And I remember being struck when I read it of, you know, it's like, this is a very visual scene. I see everything going on here. And you, I don't always with a lot of writing, you put the details in that you need to understand what's going on, but you don't actually see it. And I thought economically with words, which is kind of a goofy writer way of speaking, but I mean, it's like when you do this as much as we do, it's like, that's the shorthand. But I think you have a really good ability to describe things and to put the reader in a place. And that's such a huge thing. It's very empathetic to the reader. So my question is, this is a writer question. It's less about, you know, guns and all the other stuff. Do you visualize, or what do you see when you're writing a scene? I know it's a very general question, but like, what details do you write the scene and leave it the way it is? Or do you write a scene and then go back and kind of like, put other coats of paint on it as far as details? Do you have a way of thinking about that?
Well, we've talked about this a lot. And it's, you know, it means a lot to me as friends, and as I've always looked up to you, we've talked a lot about craft. And so, you know, on, I think it was Burner, you had a scene where Zoya walks into this room, and I even told you, like, you described so much about that scene by the way she's walking, but what she's wearing. And like, I'd never seen it before when you did it. And like, it was one of those things that, it's kind of like a friendly challenge. Like, you don't know it exists until mm-hmm. you're like, holy, it's like you hear the White Album or something, you know, and you're like, you know, what the, because, you know, and there's like an interesting story too about Paul McCartney and Brian Wilson, where like, they would hear each other's music and he was like, I don't even know that was possible. And then the next guy would try to do it. And so when I first started writing, I was very visual. I kind of like looked at everything like I was his camera. And
yeah,
it was kind of easy back then. And now it's gotten difficult to write things. And so sometimes I feel like something to say you're talking about, if I would go back and read it, I'd be like, man, that sucks. You know, because it's like, you just really never know. You know when it's okay. And like, mm-hmm. I try to anchor the scenes, especially after reading that chapter you did, is like, I try to learn something between writing one book and writing another book.
Yeah.
Like, what is like this new tool that I can bring here? Right. If I'm lucky, maybe I can bring two or three tools. But for me, a lot of that, and I've tried to do it before, but I noticed a lot of things in Burner, it's her, you know, it's such a challenge, like bringing women into these books in some ways, I feel. And I had a little more of a challenge with this one editorially, because some people thought that, like, hey, if you, maybe there's this new idea. I don't know. I'm not trying to put anybody's words in anybody's mouth, but things that I put in about a way a woman looked, certain readers that read it were like, you're objectifying this woman. I'm like, why? Mm-hmm. They used, you know, this word like raven haired. And like, I was like, oh, okay, I could change that. But, you know, you're kind of challenged to how do you do this? And so, the visual thing is like, I don't know. Sometimes, you know, when you write a scene and it works, you just leave it. I felt that there were quite a few places going through where I didn't hit it right. Like, I have trouble with like landscapes and stuff, and you know, reading some of the stuff you did, like the way you capture it right away. I don't know.
Well,
I'm really surprised to hear you say that.
Well, we're all our own worst critics, but you are actually kind of famous amongst writers as being your own worst
critic.
Worst of the worst critics. You are like a one-star reviewer of yourself. You're legendary. You're probably talked about more than any other author that I know.
I was talked about today in an email from a man that we both love and admire. And he said, not to psychoanalyze you, but I have the uncanny ability to get so far in my head that I like literally become my own enemy. And it's has become legendary in the last couple of years. And thank God I worked through it in this one.
You definitely have.
That was you know, you talked on Rogan about imposter syndrome. So I went from like, I was like a creative hypochondriac. If somebody would say something, they're like, you have writer's block. I'm like, that's bad, dude. That's why I can't write. And like, yeah,
whatever anybody would say.
Yep, that's exactly what I
have. All right, so do I get to speak up as a reader? Come on, guys.
Yeah, go for it.
I have read your Love Them books because we have talked, you know, talked about them. And I read this book and I think, you know, you've developed a different voice for this book. I think the writing, it's, you know, it's spare. One thing, you don't have a lot of wiggle words in this, you know, it's the Elmore Leonard thing, leaving out the words that readers skip. But also the pace of this book, especially, you know, in the beginning, these is so rapid that if you had a lot of words, you would really slow it down.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think you've adapted a voice here that suits, you know, what you're trying to do. And going back to the other thing, I mean, you know, the two guys that got Goshen out of Japan, for example, that was a really interesting extraction exercise. But were they part of a company or were they just freelancing?
I believe they were one of them was ex-Special Forces. I think they were like kind of hired under the radar because I believe at the same time, then a couple more Green Berets try to go into some country and they got busted doing stuff.
Yeah.
And so there's all these guys that are like, I got a great idea.
Venezuela. Yeah. A bunch of guys. I just listened to a really good podcast about the Carlos Ghosn thing. And I honestly don't remember if they were part of a bigger company or if they were just hired on.
Well, but it was
a guy and his son.
Yeah, it was a guy and his son. It was a really daring move. But one of the reasons I mentioned it is that there have been consequences for them, you know, or at least attempted consequences.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's a question that I think, you know, we'll look at the Wagner Group. That's a mercenary group. And now today we find out that Putin has admitted now that it was all state financed, you know, and you look at the amount of money, you know, not only was the guy supplying fighters for billions, but he was also catering for the Russian army. For all this money.
So
it seems to me that these private companies, there are permutations beyond. And as you point out, there's a difference between a private eye and a cop in the sense that if you're writing a police procedural, you have to stick with, you know, the cops anyway, theoretically, you have to stick with what they, you know, the legal parameters and so forth. Mm-hmm. Just the private eye can do almost anything. And it seems to me that these mercenary companies operate without the same kind of tight restriction and oversight and all that a more formal military operation has.
That's kind of the point, especially with Wagner Group. And, you know, like if you go back to like Sandline and Executive Outcomes, like technically mercenaries or private military companies are illegal in Africa. And you know, that all came from like, you know, the conflict diamond, conflict mineral stuff. And you know, a couple of years ago when I first thought about writing this book, I reached out to a guy who he was a SEAL, of course, and he helped stand up the Iraqi SWAT team, and they were basically this kidnap rescue team. Basically he got out, and then I cannot remember the guy's name, but there's an American that was kidnapped in Syria. They killed him. These British ISIS guys ended up like killing him. Like, it wasn't Sean Foley at all. I can't remember what his name was, I cannot remember his name.
Yeah,
maybe it was Sean Foley.
Yeah, no. I mean, he was the photographer guy that they executed.
And
Scott Foley.
Thank you. So basically they were asking, they said like, hey, we want like $200,000 and we'll let them go. And the FBI was like, we don't negotiate with terrorists. So the family actually hired this guy that I talked to, and he put together a crew and he was going to go rescue them. And the FBI said, like, if you do that, we're going to arrest you because you're financing terrorism, but also you're kidnapping somebody because you can't go to another country and, like, even if they ask you to, pull them out of that country. And I'm like, I don't know about all that.
Yeah.
So there's all these different little loopholes that you know, it just makes it so interesting because it seems like a lot of these guys, you know,
it's kind of a Wild West world. And I think, you know, it's wonderful for a writer to be able to, you know, to use that. I mean, you have to set up in this book, you set up a bad guy, at least one. And, you know, I thought for a while we were going to stay in the world of the PC because you did it so well. But, it, you know, it turns out that is a setup for our guy here, whose name is, I'm terrible on names, especially when I'm
Travis. Yeah. Travis Lane. Yeah.
And, you know, I thought you did that so well. And it also made me think about, you know, battlefield medicals have really improved. So remember this whole deal that just came up about the blood clotting, a company that had found a really great blood clotting thing in the army guy that, you know, he wanted to use his own and he didn't want to take this new, whatever it is, but, you know, the advances in treating guys on the field. And you have a scene in here where, saves a life by, you know, a guy who's like, I assume it's his artery, femoral artery is pierced. And, you know, your guy not only is in there with guns and all the rest of it, but he's whipping out tourniquets and, you know, trying to save this guy's life. So it seems to me that these rescue guys with the medics, I mean, their game is huge compared to, you know, if you're just but it's bigger than just combat.
Yeah. And that's what was so fascinating is because, you know, I had to learn like a few things about this, like besides like the tactics, the techniques usually come pretty easy, but then it was like, oh, this guy's not a medic. He basically, like during their training, they go and do rotations at ERs and Miami-Dade and stuff like that. So they're literally qualified as paramedics or EMT, whichever the higher one is. And, paramedic, yeah. And so they could do everything up to some versions of brain surgery. You know, and the reason they only deploy for about 3 months at a time is because they have so many licenses that they have to keep current. Like the PJs were the first people to ever carry whole blood in Afghanistan, which was a big deal because the doctors would basically only a doctor, like a surgeon, is supposed to have that over there. And so they would have to sign it out to the PJs to carry whole blood because they talk about like the golden hour. Their motto is if they can get somebody within an hour of being wounded to a hospital, they're going to save their lives. And so they were the first people to like start using ketamine. And it's really amazing what they're doing in the back of a helicopter. You know, they're doing just chest decompressions, which is, but you know, they're doing venous, like arterial cut downs. They're doing all this stuff, which is like pretty sterile.
Josh, what is the thing that, and I've seen them do it in the back of helicopters, if you can't get an IV in and time is of the essence, because it's hard to get it.
Like, yeah, it's an IO. The first time I saw that, I almost threw up.
Oh my God. They do a thing where they stick I won't even call it a needle. I mean, it's a
drill.
It's like a drill right into your thigh bone, right? And it goes straight into your bone marrow. And it's basically they try and get an IV in you, but if you're going to bleed out or whatever, they're like, or you need fluids or whatever, they're like, nope, we're going to do this. And it'll just slam it right into your bone marrow. And then it's easier, but not easier for the patient. It's easier for the...
Well, Amy, my wife's a nurse, and it's funny because the first time I ever saw that, I was on patrol working, you know, for Shelby County. And there was this huge car wreck, and it was out in the middle of, literally in the middle of the country, like nowhere. They brought in this life flight helicopter, and they couldn't stick the guy. And so I did some medical stuff, and I'm just watching or whatever. And these guys get off the helicopter, and, you know, they're trying to put fluid in because they're trying to volumize the blood. They can't get any fluid. And they're like, we can't get a vein. This dude's like, no problem. Literally, this is what I saw. I don't know. This is before I'd ever heard about it or whatever. This dude pulls out a drill. It was yellow. It looks like a DeWalt drill. And obviously it was some type of medical grade drill. But he starts drilling into this dude. And I'm like, what in the hell are you doing? He's like, relax, bro. You know, and he stuck did the IO. He basically stuck a catheter in his marrow. And I'm So I go home and I'm telling my wife, I'm like, you're never going to believe this dude's got a drill and he's drilling. She's like, yeah, we do that at the hospital. And I'm like, the guy wouldn't even scream and he must have been dead. She's like, no, it doesn't hurt. And I'm like, he drilled something into that person's leg. Like, I don't care how, you know, out of it you are. Like, that's going to hurt.
Right. And but my point was that, you know, there is increasingly greater chance to save people because of all, you know, battlefield medicine advances. Therefore, you know, this group that you were writing about, it seems to me, is becoming more essential. I mean, because it used to be if the helicopter went down, you know, the chances that you were going to save anybody were low. And and now, you know, there's every opportunity to, well, not every, there is opportunity to save
people. We get very advanced care. That's one thing that I thought was fascinating. And, you know, I thought it'd be interesting to try to tell a story. When I first started thinking about it, I wanted to tell a story and I pitched it as a book that is half Romancing the Stone, like meets SEAL Team Six. And so I like the idea of, you know, you have this action type thing, but you also, I always love that, you know, Kathleen Turner and what's his name?
Michael Douglas.
This tough woman and this kind of tough guy, and they're like not really taking shit from each other. And I thought that'd be kind of cool, little story, like if you just had them in the middle of nowhere.
Right? Yeah. So can you talk a little bit about Mia Webb, who's another character in the book? You know, I like books with strong female characters, and I've, you know, when as I was reading that character, I was wondering if she was someone that you created out of whole cloth, or you served with people in the military or in law enforcement or something like that, that you kind of felt like you drew from when you created Mia, because she's an FBI special agent.
Mia was a pain in the ass. and originally going into the book, it was like, I have this woman and, you know, she's going to meet this guy and the guy's going to save her. And like, it was so simple. That was kind of my outline. Everybody's like, yeah, okay. And so I had Travis down, but then I had to kind of build, like you said, Mia from this whole cloth. And so it was kind of trial and error. Like if, you know, I'd let my wife read it and like, well, she seems kind of like bitchy or presumptuous and all these things that I would never think of. It's like, and so like she took the most time, and I don't know, like it was kind of like I'd like to, you know, you're trying to like, you have to create, you know, who you're putting them up against. It's kind of like with you and Zoya. So I guess it's hard to explain, but they have to hold their own, right? They can't just be like, and so that's the problem I had. I spent all this time doing it, and then finally I got to put them together. And in my mind, it was like they get together and Travis Lane's like, let's go. And she's like, okay, save me. And then, but I'd spent so much time, you know, and they become like almost real. And I'm trying to write that page and I hear her just being like, I'm not going anywhere with you. Like, who the hell are you? You know, and I'm like, oh,
but
crap,
there's another woman in this, you know, Josh, because, you know, Travis has a sister too. And the sister situation with the family farm, she needs saving too. It comes up in the beginning, but we've talked about how Travis is doing his PJ thing and all, but he's had an injury and he's really physically not able to do a lot of the stuff that he used to do. So you found a way to transition him out of the military and towards this mercenary world, so to speak, private operations enterprise. And the sister is the reason for it. So you want to explain that a little bit?
Well, for me, the sister was easier to write from a point of view is that they had like a natural link. Like it made sense why they would be together. They, you know, they were, it's his sister. And so originally it had been that she and her husband, who actually gets killed, that's the first thing, like, as I'm checking off these blocks, I'm like, will people buy that this guy and his brother-in-law are in the same unit? And I was like, well, let's see. And then it's like, okay, how would that work? And then you kind of go, and then he gets killed. And so there are these little kind of speed bumps you hit along the way. And I felt that them being together was a lot easier. It made more logical sense. They're related. She's gone through like something traumatic. He's gone through something traumatic. They're bonded together by family and this farm. And so I felt that was a little easier to write. Meanwhile, you know, Mia's just kind of on this parallel path where she's doing her own thing. And it was trying to figure out like how to off ramp both of them and then merge them. That was so difficult. And that's why I felt it was a little more difficult with her. I felt more comfortable, I guess, with Travis's sister.
Yeah. And she read like she was a sister, like that their personalities or whatever. There was, you know, like there was a familiarity. So you don't have a sister, do you?
No, but I get to watch the kids a little bit, and it was way more complicated to, and I don't even know if I pulled it off 100%, but when you start, you know, trying to make strong female characters go along with the strong male characters, I felt like woefully out of depth really quickly.
Yeah.
Well, the sister is a strong character, you know, since Mark likes strong women, and so do I in these books. You know, the sister, when we say she needs some sort of rescuing, it's not because she's a wimp or anything.
Right.
Yeah,
she's just an untenable financial situation with no particular way to get out of it. But, you know, she too is a strong person.
Yeah. And I love the blue collar aspect of the story. I really relate to. Like, I really, and I think people will relate to, you know, Travis is doing what he's doing to save his family farm. And that takes him all over the world, and that takes him into like incredibly precarious things. He doesn't know that when he, you know, signs up to save his family farm. But still, I thought, you know, it's really compelling when you see somebody, you know, make a decision for the good of the family, and then it just turns into this thing that takes all of their, you know, special skills that they have and a lot of moral questions as they go along. So I was really drawn to that. Will we see more Travis Lane in future books? What's the plan with that?
I hope so. I mean, that's kind of the publisher's call. Like, I have a lot more books I'd like to do. You know, I got kind of stuck in that portion where it was like, you write to this point, you're like, I got to go to Africa. But then when you kind of get him home, you're like, man, I wonder what kind of trouble he could get in around here.
Yeah.
And it was one of those things where I'd never really written that much of a stateside thing. It was kind of cool to write about Memphis, Carville, that area and stuff. So I hope so. I think there's a lot of interesting things you could do with that. Yeah. And it was exciting and fun to read.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, sorry.
I will say that I probably read, 2,500 thrillers in my life. And this was the first novel I've ever read that my stepson was sort of tangentially mentioned, because Wilson Air Service is mentioned because the family.
I wondered if you're going to pick up on that.
Collierville. And my stepson is heir to the Cummins Wilson, the Holiday Inn people. And then, like, when I read that, I was going like, well, that's kind of surreal to read this. And then I go back to like, wait, this is Josh. This is Josh's book. When you get really lost in a book and you're an author and you know most of the writers, I mean, you're so into the book and you're not thinking about who's writing it. And it was kind of that where I was going like, oh, wait, this Josh wrote this. That's pretty funny, because that is it's a Memphis thing. It's a fixed-based operator or whatever you call it at the airport. Yeah.
And that was the only, you know, when I was on SWAT, when people would fly in, that was where they go. I think there's Signature maybe, and then there's Wilson, or Wilson owns all of it. But I was, I didn't think about it till after I had written it. And it was just one of those things where it's like, Kimmins Wilson. I was like, oh, I wonder, you know, it's one of those things where you don't put the names together and all the things.
Yeah, yeah.
And, yeah, and it's like, sometimes it would be so much easier if you could write a book where you live, you know, like kind of maybe CJ Box or them, because you don't have to do any research. Like, go drive down the street and be like, oh, I'd do it there, and he'd go there.
Right.
And it's like, why haven't I done this earlier in my
career? Why am I writing about North Korea?
Right. Yeah, I'm just
a self-inflicted wound.
I've just done all this research. Tennessee,
you know, Tennesseans are really, I mean, I used to live there, you know, in Oak Ridge and Knoxville. And, you know, you could really do a lot with Tennessee. The Memphis, Knoxville, you know, Nashville thing is it's like three different countries as you're moving along. But there's a fair amount of wild country there. There's mountain country, you know, you've got the river on one side, you've got, you know, the Appalachian Trail on the other side. And I read the other day that Knoxville is doing some, I mean, it was a really kind of dingy, dirty river town when I lived there, but Knoxville's really come along. So, and then there's always Oak Ridge, which has got a lot of interesting history to it. So
you can,
I could swear, you know, it's very rare that a publisher says this is the start of a series and then publishes one book. So, you know, I was under the impression that there was at least two.
I got myself in a little trouble. This has never happened before. So they originally it was going to be this and then the next one. And so as we were talking about the next book, one of the editors said standalone. And so just to clarify, I said, do you mean a standalone in that you don't have to read The Guardian to read the next one? Or do you mean standalone in like a totally different book that has nothing to do with Travis Lane? That it was kind of like one of those things that the minute I sent it, I was like, that was probably not good, because I knew what the answer was going to be. And it was like, I don't know, do you have something else? And so kind of on the spot, I should have been like, no, I don't. But on the spot, I was like, well, I've got this idea that I've been kicking around about this smoke jumper who was a convict. So he's a criminal who becomes a smoke jumper. And then he ends up getting in this trouble with these cartel and drug deals up in the National Forest. And they're like, wait, what? And I was like,
That Lee Goldberg just wrote that book. I swear to you.
Well, maybe I should.
It's called Malibu Burning. And I just read it. And it is indeed about a thief in prison in California who decides to plead guilty so that he can become a firefighter or prison smoke jumper.
Well, apparently there's a show about it too, except.
I mean, it's okay not to do one book like that. It was
Just don't do it in Malibu. I guess
it's like the universal consciousness. So they're like, well, that's pretty interesting. And one of the people on the editorial staff, her husband was actually a wildland firefighter. And like, well, there's not that many books about that. So it was like, hey, you want to write this one next? And I was like,
why can't Travis be a firefighter?
I was going to say, you could thread that together.
It's too late, Mark. This is due Friday. I'm not changing it.
We do that to each other all the time. Josh and I will be talking on the phone about a problem with our book, and then the advice the other person gives involves a complete rewrite of your entire story. Yeah. So it's like, but we keep doing it to each other. I'm like, well, you know, maybe if you
that's
know
what
your
I
hero
should have done, I should have been
if
like,
your hero
should have been
a butterfly, you know, just a small little tweak to the story.
I think I do that more to you than you do it to me. But like, if I'd had this conversation with you 4 months ago, I'd have been like, I'll just make this dude a smoke jumper, and we'd had no problems. But
Another interesting thing about our job is you write the book and then it gets out there, and then all the subject matter experts that you wish you knew a year ago are calling to bitch about something or you know, like emailing.
I just had that happen.
Yeah. And they're going like, as somebody that, you know, is on the third floor at CIA in the corner next to the cafeteria, I can tell you that the coffee machine or whatever, and I'm going like, I don't need you now. I needed you a year ago. But
what's worse is when you write that person multiple times and you email them, etc.,
and you don't hear.
They don't answer you. And then the book comes out and they're like, hey, I didn't know you were writing a book about a PJ. You know, I was a PJ. And you're like, yeah, remember that last 8 months where I sent you like an email today that says, can you please help me with my PJ book? That's what we were talking about. And
editorial is a long process. You may still have time to make it, you know.
And not with this one.
I've talked this story before, but David Morrell once was writing a book and suddenly realized that it was going to be way too close to the Rambo universe, which he doesn't own. So, I mean, you know, he can't do that. And he recognized that if he just went back and changed the characters' names, he would be fine and go along. So there's nothing to actually prevent you from doing that. Yeah. You have a good conversation.
Yeah. Well, now I'm going to have to go read Lee Goldberg's book.
This is why we're stealing
anything. Damn it.
So before we call up Patrick, or Patrick, come and join us. Mark, tell us where you are. I know you said you were on deadline. Are we looking at a February book?
Yes, I have my book, the 13th Gray Man novel, is called The Chaos Agent, and it will be out next February 20th. I'm turning in the first draft on July 8th. So I'm actually down here on vacation in Florida, but I have not been out to the beach. I've looked at it through the window. It's very nice. And, you know, everybody, all the family is walking around smelling like coconut, you know, like spray.
You're half tan. So,
yeah.
I need to turn this way.
Exactly. Yeah. So I'm just here for the drinks and a place to sit and work. So, but no, yeah, I'll turn it in July 8th. And then I'm writing another book this year, the second book in the Armored series. And it will be out next July. So I'll have two books out next year. And then I will never do that again as long as I live. And I've said that before, but I really feel
like. Did you do that for the first like
10 years?
Five or 6 years of your, 10 years of
your
life.
Yes, he did. He was very prolific. Well, I'm excited because that gets, we get to see more of Mark that way.
Yeah.
A year is only one time.
Which always means I get to come to, you know, means I'll get to hopefully come to Poison Pen in July when it's 128 degrees and it's, feels like two people are following you with hair dryers, pulling them in your face.
But you get to come in February when it's really nice. So
it's perfect. Yeah. It's so beautiful in February. It's so
right. Nice. Anyway, that's very good news. I'm delighted to hear that. Patrick, do we have any questions from the audience?
There are some questions. Good. Some of these you may have already answered, so I'm sorry. Let's see. Renee would like to know, Josh, was your wife in the service or is she also a writer?
No, she is a nurse and she doesn't even like my book. No.
I would read a book that Amy wrote. I really would. I think that would be fun.
Oh my gosh.
Medical thrillers are great, you know, and they're not many of them. So you should have a thought.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, she was not. And she's an avid reader though. And
kind of a related question. Did you work with many women when you were in the military?
I did not. I was in an infantry battalion. I think it maybe has changed, but there were no women in the infantry. So you'd see them on base on like Fort Bragg, but no, I never worked with any. I'm sure it would have been awesome though.
Here's a question. Yeah, Mark, what's going on with Rip? Is he still in overseas?
So Rip, I guess, is back and forth. I talked to him. We texted in the last week or two. He started a charity for Ukraine, supporting Ukraine, actually supporting battalion in Ukraine. And I'm super proud of him. I've donated to the charity myself. I absolutely believe in the charity and believe in him. He's literally one of the most interesting people that I know. And we are going to be writing a Red Medal too. It would have already happened now, except for the invasion of Russia. And Rip just reached out to me after the invasion. He'd already been over there with his wife and they've been helping charities. And he's like, listen, man, you know, this is what I've trained for 25 years, 23 years or whatever as a Marine. And I feel like I can do some good over here. And I was like, you know what? I totally support that. And the publisher supports that and everything. And we'll do the book when we can do the book.
He got bored writing a first book, making the New York Times list after just getting out of fighting two wars. And I was like, I'm going to go fight another war. Then I'm going to write another book.
Yeah, that's in his DNA.
He's pretty amazing.
He's a badass. Yeah.
He's a really, really interesting guy. I was so happy to get to meet him when you brought him to the store. And, you know, and he's written, what, one or two books on his own?
Two,
isn't it? I think
about that. That's right.
Yeah. But, you know, I think his priorities are sound. And, we'll see how it works out. Patrick, anything else?
Yeah, let's see. So you both have written legacy series, you know, for different authors, obviously, Mark with Tom Clancy and Josh with Ludlum. Are there any authors who you think, wow, I would love to take a stab at trying to write a, you know, like
one day I'd like to write
McLean or
yeah.
You like what?
I want to take over the gray man one day when he gets tired of writing. I'm not kidding. Hey, I've told you that before.
You have. Will you finish this one? I'll give you. You can take it over tonight.
I'm reading
due a week
it now.
Saturday.
I think it's great. Right, I don't know man. What your problem is. You talk about me being hard on myself. I'm like, you said there was an issue, and I'm almost done. I haven't found it yet, but
so that's a really good question though, and I haven't really thought about it. But you know, like I think of like my favorite authors. But I think of somebody like Jean Le Carré, and it's like, oh, I'd love to do that. I can't do it, but I'd love to do it. So it's not that, you know, like, I feel like I'm the net. I feel like Clancy was, when I was offered that, if you had said any legacy, you know, author out there, the one whose canon I knew more than anyone else would be Tom Clancy. Maybe Nelson DeMille, although he didn't have a bunch of series. I mean, he had a little bit of John Corey back then, I guess, but really Clancy would be the, you know, so I just, how fortuitous was it that happened to me? But yeah, Josh, don't say me because that makes it sound like I've departed this world and you've taken
well,
over.
I just said, you know, I've told you many times, like, why don't you just go do something else and let me do this? Cause like, I feel like
you'd be my first choice.
The only person that I could like match fairly closely, like, I think I get his sense of humor. I've told you multiple times, like, I've been in the gym on the older books just laughing, like, when stuff Court says, because I can hear you say it. And I know, I'm like, I could hear Mark saying it, therefore I could hear Court saying it. So I think that's honestly not to be a kiss ass, but I can't think of ever doing that again unless it was something, like, that I would literally enjoy doing.
Yeah.
Well, Kyle, you know, and then now Don are going to be doing the Vince Flynn world.
Yeah.
Do you ever read, like when you're reading, you know, your colleagues doing this, think, you know what, I would have done this a little bit different here? Or do you see the seams in the books, like when you're reading?
Oh, can I take that one first? Yeah, so I do feel like I would do it differently a lot, but that doesn't mean it's better or worse. Like,
right, sure.
You know, like I read Mark Cameron and I go like, oh my God, I wish I thought of that. I absolutely wish I thought about it. And then you turn this page and go like, yeah, but you could also go this way or this way. So, I mean, that's just that everybody's different. And I've always, you know, I'm pretty passionate about people that take over the legacy writing, not trying to replicate what was done before, just taking those characters and writing them in your own voice, but also, you know, obviously being respectful to where it was. So, you know, I think we all fit into that pretty well. But like, you know, the Don Bentley doing the Jack Ryan Jr. books, Don writes just really visceral action, and you know, he's one of those guys that like cranks it up to 11 and then starts from there. And then so there's times I'll be reading a Don Bentley book and I'll be like, oh, let's just have everybody go to a coffee shop for 30 minutes, please. I need a minute. You know, so I would write it differently, but like, it's so good. And it's so cool for readers that, you know, like me, who like these legacy characters, getting to see another take on these characters. So if it's done right, you know, I would never phone a book in. My friends would never phone a book in, but you know, like if you tried to phone it in and be like, I'm going to try and sound like Clancy and like use ChatGPT and write, you know, Patriot Games 2024 or something like that, I think that would be horrible. So I think it's great that the different writers have their different voices and views.
Do you have to have a lead character like the Ryans or in order to do this? I mean, Nelson, I love Nelson's books. But, you know, he has that one character. But and I was thinking, there was a thing, I was really, this is a terrible thing to say, but I didn't even know he was still alive. But the New York Times did a profile on Len Dayton in the book review on Sunday. And I suddenly thought, wow, you know, I mean, but there's another, I mean, maybe that's why nobody's writing them, because he's still with us at 90 something. But
yeah, that's fantastic.
Yeah. So maybe the authors who have a character, it's easier to take them over than, you know, if you've got a more scattered approach to it.
Yeah, I think it would have to be, because if you know, like I wrote, you know, a Nelson DeMille novel, it could be anything. It could be a whole bunch of different things.
He's still alive, so he'd probably object.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah, he did. I'm saying, if
that's the ultimate goal, though, I don't understand. Like, I want to get to the place where someone can write my books like for me while I'm still alive, and they're you know, it's like everybody likes my books.
On Lee Child. And I just we're all working to be Lee Child. Let's be honest.
I actually go to Florida and actually get to see, like, feel the beach. That's my goal. Is like, we're going to Florida in 2 weeks, and you know what I'll be doing? I'll be finishing up like edits and stuff, and be like, can you bring me a cup of sand or something? It would be nice, I think, to be like, yeah, I'm out here. Yeah. I've done a lot of
Child, we've already booked Andrew for October 23rd, I think it is.
He's
carrying on. And it's interesting to have watched Andrew's progression writing his brother. It's got it's gone in a really good direction, I think.
That's good. That's great. Yep. I have Andrew Grant's first book he signed for me, my first Thriller Fest, you know, like right when I got published. So that's like a cool, proud possession of mine.
Yeah, he's a sweetheart. But, you know, it's interesting to see he's very different than his brother. His style in his own books was so different. It's been interesting to watch him, you know, move along into a Jack Reacher voice. I hear my puppies barking insanely in the garage, so any moment we're going to have a giant thing. Is there anything else, Patrick?
No, not really.
I'm going to let Rob open the door so you can always see.
So they'll attack you.
Come home. They're just like insane, right? Anyway, it's really been a pleasure, Josh.
Thank you so much.
And that. One of the things that I think is a real joy for me, maybe not everybody who reads these books, but I learn a lot. I mean, I'm probably never going to go to Bahrain, as I mentioned earlier. The chances that I'll go to Djibouti are fairly small. but I also learned about this whole military, you know, the PJs that I didn't know anything about. And I think it's really good for us, you know, to do. There we go.
There they come.
Right. I think we'll stop. Right. So thank you very much, everybody.
Thank you.
Yep. It was a real pleasure. Thanks for letting us spend some time with you, both of you, Mark and John.
All righty.
I enjoyed it.
We do have hello. All of you. Okay. Bye.
Bye.
Take care, guys.
Bye. All righty. Thank you.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.